WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to Libya Christopher Stevens and three members of his staff were murdered during an attack on our consulate in Benghazi. On Thursday, the U.S. Embassy in the capital of Yemen was attacked. During that time and through the weekend, riotous mobs threatened our embassy in Egypt, even as violence was directed at U.S. embassies in Tunisia and Sudan. Protesters also gathered outside our embassy in London, Jakarta, Indonesia, and Bangladesh, as well as other cities around the region. All of this because of an amateur film ridiculing the Muslim prophet Muhammad and portraying him in dubious and distasteful ways. The incidents highlight the precarious nature of conditions in the Middle East, the tension between East and West, and the suspicions of those in the Islamic world about our intentions toward their religion. It also highlights the dangers faced by our diplomatic corps around the world, the wisdom of placing these representatives in volatile locations, and our ability to keep them safe. To talk about this, we're joined by Mark Irwin, who served as the U.S. ambassador, and I should have asked how to pronounce this, U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Mauritius?
Mauritius.
Mauritius. Where is that?
Indian Ocean, just off the east coast of Kenya.
Okay. Also the Republic of the Seychelles and the Federal Islamic Republic of Comoros from 1999 to 2001. Welcome back.
Good to see you.
Dr. Beth Whitaker is Associate Professor and Associate Chair and Undergraduate Director of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Nice to have you with us again.
Good to be back, Mike.
Dr. Bill Brandon is the Metrolina Medical Foundation Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at UNC Charlotte. Good to see you as well again.
Good morning.
And L.J. Stambuck is usually behind the scenes during these shows. He's president of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte and has brought more than his share of guests to this program, but today he himself is one. Thank you for being here, too.
Good morning. Thank you.
The trouble in Libya is said to have caught us off guard, although personnel were told to be extra vigilant because of the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. There were, I'm told, no intelligence warnings that trouble was brewing. How can that be? I don't know who to ask that question of.
Well, you know, there are a lot of signals that you receive at an embassy about threats and threat levels and so on and so forth. And with 9/11 approaching, it would have been wise in retrospect for the ambassador to have stayed in the embassy rather than going to a consulate. The embassy is a very hardened facility and much more difficult to penetrate. The consulate is more or less an office building.
But Ambassador Irwin, you just said it would have been wise in retrospect. How many lessons do we have to learn before we learn the lesson?
I don't know. That's still going to be investigated for months and months to come to determine exactly what went on.
And Ambassador Stevens was, as we said, at the consulate in Benghazi, not at the embassy in Tripoli. And you just alluded to the fact that the embassy in Tripoli is hardened. Why?
That's typically the place that's most the highest profile place to be attacked.
Sure. But then if your ambassador goes to the various consulates or goes to areas outside of the main embassy, would a security detail of some force, particularly in that part of the world, not follow him? If we see the need to harden our embassy in a capital city, why wouldn't we have a detailed force that goes with the ambassador wherever he goes within that country?
Well, he did have a force going with him, and three members were killed. They were private contractors. Two of them Navy SEALs, I believe, and they were all killed with him. Chris was a great ambassador. He was one of our best, I really believe. Mm-hmm. But he was a man of the people, and he loved the people there and tried his best to be a part of the community. And that's a risk that you take when you do that.
Yeah, I read in the paper this morning that it's our embassy, our State Department, is saying that in killing Ambassador Stevens, they killed one of the leading proponents of that part of the world, a person who genuinely wanted to understand those people, who did understand them to a great degree. You're nodding yes and no here.
Well, I think that many people go into the Foreign Service really do want to be out there with the people and interacting with people, and that's one of the challenges here. There's a trade-off between security and being able to do your job, which many consider to be reaching out to the people in the country where they're serving. I was in Tanzania on August 7th, 1998, when the embassy, the U.S. embassy there was bombed, and the embassy in Nairobi as well. And since that time, the U.S. has built these massive fortresses as embassies in those two countries. And that has they've taken a hit in terms of public opinion in those two countries, because the people serving in those embassies are seen as behind closed walls, and not as they can't interact as easily because of these
fortresses. I was going to talk about that. Let's talk about it now, because what does that say about us, about our foreign policy? Do we have to have these mighty fortresses for embassies around the world simply because we're the big dog and we're the big target? Or is it something that we're doing that people are responding in a negative way to, that then we have to defend ourselves against? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, clearly with that experience in 1998, U.S. embassies were targeted.
Right.
So there is a security concern.
And obviously they still are.
But it is true that the perception is that perhaps the U.S. has protected itself too much, at least the perception among people in some of these countries. Having been in Kenya 2005, 2006, talking to people about sort of their perceptions of the U.S. and U.S. policy, there was definitely a sense that perhaps the U.S. was doing too much to protect itself and less to protect people who its allies in those countries.
Well, L.J. Stenbuck, you told one of our producers, you're the son of a diplomat.
I'm a son of a diplomat, yep.
And you remarked that security around embassies today is much different than it was a generation ago, particularly for American embassies. Talk about that.
If you go to Geneva and you go down Embassy Row, it's striking to see the embassy of Italy, even Russia, and others. Our buildings, which are accessible, our building is full of barbed wire and concrete and guards. I understand the need for that, and I actually want to go back a little bit in time. Paul Bremer, who headed our coalition in Iraq in 2003 after the invasion, said that actually when he was ambassador to the Netherlands 25 years ago, he could not go out and have pizza with his kids without a security detail. Mm-hmm. So the work and life of a diplomat has always been dangerous. You're always exposed. What you don't want to do is to be behind the barbed wire all the time. You have to go out. You have to meet with people. You have to talk to people. You have to understand. And that's what Ambassador Stevens did. He was really someone who was engaged in Libya. He lived there. He was deputy chief of mission for 2 years. Then he was our head envoy during the revolution against Gaddafi. So he knew people in Benghazi. He felt at home in Benghazi. And maybe, just maybe, he let down his guard a little bit too much.
But are there, you talked about particularly American embassies around the world being hardened, being fortresses. Are there other nations that have to do what we have done to our embassies in order to keep their diplomatic corps safe?
I just came back from Kabul. I was in Kabul in April, just before the Haqqani network attacked our embassy and the Western embassies in Kabul. And nowadays, the German embassy, the British embassy, many other embassies look like our embassies.
But that you're talking about people who are allied with us in the struggle against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Exactly.
In the hot spot of the fight, Kabul. But in Geneva, Switzerland, which is not exactly a hot spot of any activity, it's a neutral nation, the American embassy is fortress. The other embassies are not.
You're right. And if you ask me why that is the case?
Dr. Brand.
I was just going to give an example of that I found really striking. I had a Fulbright to the Sultan of Oman, which is one of the Persian Gulf sheikdoms, not very much noticed around the world, but an interesting one. And in the Sultanate's government has moved all of the embassies along the same road. Pretty clearly, it would be defensible. This is a country that's very peaceful. It has it's authoritarian, but you don't see guns around very much. The American embassy has, and I guess this is typical, an outbuilding where you come through. They take your cell phone. You go through incredible searches and such. And then you go to a large courtyard, which, of course, gives a defensive perimeter before you get to the building where there are a couple of Marines that meet you. The embassy next door to that is the Indian embassy. And beyond – and the next one to that, if my memory serves, maybe two down the road, is the embassy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, the Iranians, of course, are they lost seven diplomats in Afghanistan, so they are sitting targets in Sunni-controlled the Sunni-controlled world, too. They had one sort of half-baked guard when I went to visit the embassy on some business. And they said, oh, what do you want? And I said, oh, I'm interested in talking with one of the consuls. And so they brought me in, no security at all. And there was an Arab guy in dishdash, in the kind of Arab robes, chatting up a female Iranian diplomat, young woman who was there at the consular office. And they switched to English from Arabic when I got there, and there was just it was just totally without, seemingly without any kind of security.
Well, you know, I grew up in the D.C. area, and I had to go to work several times down Embassy Row, what is called Embassy Row in Washington, although it's not completely embassies. But it was hard to distinguish sometimes an embassy from a private home. Today, if you try to get into the Capitol building in Washington, which I used to have free access to as a citizen, the same is true. You go to an outbuilding, you go through metal detectors, you go through all kinds of things to get into the Capitol, and you can only go, you can only get a ticket to get in by talking to your congressperson or their representative. Whereas it used to be, you'd walk in the door and there you were. We have become a fortress, even in our own country, after 9/11. Is that because it's necessary? Or because we have hunkered down all over the world because we're scared of our own shadows?
Now, I think if you go back in our history to the days of Abraham Lincoln, for example.
You'd walk into the White House.
You would walk into the White House, and every so often he had a situation where anybody could come and see the president,
right,
speak to him. You just line up and wait your turn and speak to the president. And in many countries, third world countries, even today, that still happens. You can have a day of the people where anybody can go up and speak to the leader of the country. But as America has grown to the most powerful and wealthiest nation in the world, we've created a lot of envy and jealousy and divisiveness by others who have less. And you certainly can see their perspective, but we have to see our perspective,
well,
too.
Well, we succeeded Great Britain as the great empire, I suppose. Did they, at the height of their power, did they have to do take similar measures for the times? Do we know?
Certainly their citizens traveled very easily. But in the Middle East, which is my focus, their famous British adventurers trotting throughout the Middle East, I think everybody was afraid of the British, and at least in the Middle East, they were very afraid of them, so they were relatively safe. But let me kind of demur a little bit here. My federal service was with the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. and the Peace Corps has always prided itself of putting people in the villages away from that. And during my time of service, I hate to say this, Ambassador, but we kind of steered as clear as we could from the embassy, and we sort of thought they were in a bubble. And there are times and places, and I remember when during the period I was there, the Philippines were an issue. All of the political officers in the embassy said that that the then dictator was Marcos was going to be reelected. And the people from the Peace Corps, it was just common knowledge, this guy's in real trouble.
It's Dr. Bill Brandon, who is professor of public policy at UNC Charlotte. He is here along with Dr. Beth Whitaker, associate professor and associate chair of the undergraduate director of political science and public administration at the university. L.J. Stanbook of World Affairs Council of Charlotte and Ambassador Mark Irwin also with us. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Celtic Thunder Voyage. The group performs Irish music and song, an homage to Ireland's musical culture. October 1st in Belk Theatre. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And James McElroy and Deal, a law firm providing litigation and business counsel to companies and individuals for more than 50 years. Details at jmdlaw.com. Well, the calendar says it's almost fall. In fact, it will be by Friday or so, I think. But the sports schedule clearly indicates that fall is here. Football is underway. The Panthers have already lost their first game, won their second game. Race week is around the corner, and soon the Bobcats will be back on the court trying to redeem themselves from last season. I know that sounds pessimistic, but we've invited some sports minds that view things a bit more optimistically. They preview the year ahead in Charlotte Sports tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, presidential politics and foreign policy, what Obama and Romney are saying and not saying about American involvement in the Middle East.
Join the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about diplomatic security. During the break, Ambassador Irwin, you were talking about how people didn't realize how dangerous it is to be in the diplomatic corps. It never occurred to me, actually, except for these isolated incidents, which appear to be at least isolated incidents, that it would be dangerous to be in the diplomatic corps. Our soldiers are being sent into harm's way, and they know they're being sent into harm's way, and they're being sent there with weapons and training. Are our diplomats being sent into harm's way with at least training?
Yes. The diplomats around the world, and we have thousands around the world, and it is a risky business. There's no question about it. We have diplomats injured and killed on a fairly consistent basis.
Because they are targeted?
Because they're targeted in many cases, but in some cases just because they're an American, they get in harm's way just because they don't even know they're a diplomat when they get in trouble.
Is the same true of Russian diplomats, German diplomats, French diplomats?
Probably more so for us because we are such a high-profile nation. And, you know, you spoke earlier about the British Empire and referred to us as an empire. We're the only empire that never really has taken territory as a spoil of war.
Mm-hmm. And
it's a different kind of an empire that we have run. So
why wouldn't the anger against the British, the height of their power, have been more for its time than it is against ours, since we seem to, even though we go to places and stay, we don't take the country?
We don't take the country, but we are still projecting our force on other people. And you have to keep in mind that here, the value of a human life is extremely high. When you go into third world countries, the value of a human life is not nearly as high, and so there's a different view of human life.
And what is that view?
It's less. A human life is less precious typically. Death is more a part of the community in third world countries than it is here. They lose children because of mosquito bites and
right.
because of the lack of an aspirin and because of the lack of fresh water, or clean water. They lose millions of people a year, millions of people a year to causes that we would think would be ridiculous.
Then does that put us at a disadvantage? I mean, we get very upset when people high profile or no profile die, particularly in a way that we think is violent or unfair or premature. And we mourn publicly and there's a gnashing of teeth, et cetera. And these other people, life goes on. So does that put us at a disadvantage?
They mourn too. They don't mourn to the same extent that we do, and they don't publicize it because they don't have the communications technology to publicize the losses that they have in small villages and so on and so forth. But it probably does put us at some form of a disadvantage.
Does it make us weak in some way or viewed as weak in some way?
I would defer to Beth on that.
I'm not sure I would agree that that human life is not as precious. And so having lived in rural areas of Kenya and Tanzania, I think there's certainly a value placed on human life. But I do think that you're asking about the time period shifts and the technology, I think, is something that's really important here, that, you know, we're talking about a video that was posted on YouTube, and the producers of that video actually contacted newspaper reporters in Egypt to publicize this and get the word out. And so, you know, comparing to the British Empire, when the ability to reach across borders, it was much more done by diplomats and done by militaries and such. And now people are reaching across borders on their own.
Let's talk about that too, because there's a columnist today in the paper, and her name is escaping me at the moment, but her column had something to do with the clash of imbeciles, because we have the imbeciles in the United States who released this film and made the contacts in Egypt, knowing full well they'd have to
that
be
incite.
That it was going to incite and inflame.
Yep.
And then we have these people rioting over this in the Middle East that she also characterized as imbecilic in terms of their behavior. In this world where things travel like that, what are we in for in the next couple of years? Because this is going to take a cultural shift on their side of the world to deal with this, it seems.
I'd say it would take a cultural shift on both sides. I mean, I think there's a tendency on both sides for people to assume that extremists on each side are representative of the broader population. And so, you know, we look at these protests and we assume, oh, they're all out there protesting. But there's also an article in the paper this morning or somewhere this morning pointing out that that the size of these protests are very, very small compared to the Arab Spring a year ago. So it's a small number of people doing it. I would argue that they have the right to protest, just as we have the right to protest. The violence, I think, is the issue. But I do think that there's a tendency on both sides to make assumptions about the whole population based on the actions of a small minority of that population.
Dr. Brandon.
I think we're approaching the really interesting question. What caused the kinds of both death and violence and general protests just over a film? And clearly in the United States, we're having a hard time because it's a matter of free speech. And we say the president can't stop that. That apparently, reading from the newspaper, is very hard to convince even some of the leaders of these states where you have rights. We have. But I think the really interesting question is, how did this get to be such a momentous occasion? One view is, well, there are always cynics and political opportunists who are going to use this in any society. In the United States, we sometimes have groups playing up some controversial issue in order to mobilize their masses. So they're the politicians and cynics. But the really interesting question to ask is, why is this compelling to the masses? Why would one film about Mohammed be compelling when the other day we got 45 or so insurgents in Afghanistan, but we managed to kill 8 women and children as collateral damage? That's not causing people to go to the streets. And that's a question I've been pondering about for a while. And it seems to me there's a really interesting answer to that. And that is that for the ordinary person in the street, the food vendor and such, why does he care about 4,000 miles away a picture of Muhammad? Why is that compelling? And maybe the answer is that in contrast to us, we're a pluralist, secular, increasingly materialistic nation where we care about our own security, exactly the kind of questions you're asking, but we really aren't tied together by any overarching insight. We have a constitution, but beyond that, people can believe what they want to. But particularly in Islam, and we're talking about the Middle East, the thing that brings people together is their religion. If you just look at the main mosque in any old town, it's right next to the bazaar. Islam really structures the way people interact, which is very different from us. I went to Iran, and I grew up in Hickory, North Carolina. People say, is Jesus Christ your Lord and Savior? And you had to make that decision probably in high school. And you were either Christian or you weren't. So I go to Iran where the idea of privacy is very different from ours. People are asking very, seeming to me, personal questions. Are you a Christian? And you'd say, well, that's kind of personal, but okay, I'll answer. Then I realized it was to distinguish me from being Jewish, that I'm part of the Christian community. And particularly in Sunni Islam, the ummah, the community, really defines things like morality and such. We have to go back to the Middle Ages in our own culture to recognize the role of, and my solution to the problem of how to answer, well, sure, I'm a Christian because I'm from Christendom, a word we don't use very much now, but hails from the Middle Ages when popular morality was informed with a kind of unified vision that incorporated religion.
This is why it's so complicated, isn't it? Because not only are we talking about people who are highly unemployed, educated and unemployed, particularly in Egypt, whose worldview is being influenced greatly by their religion, and in many cases by people that we would say, and maybe this is not true, that we would say have skin in the game. These imams, but not always. But they're certainly, and they're devout. They're devout. And when you have very few possessions and no job, and you look at the West, and it looks like we're attacking their religion, and you are devout, how else are you supposed to react? And it is, as you say, Middle Age kind of philosophy that we don't understand anymore. Am I wrong?
I would like to take it to the 21st century. I just read about a young Lebanese man. Who is internet educated, who basically said, I understand about the Constitution, your Constitution, but to us, the Muhammad is 1,000 times more important than your Constitution. Now, he's also on Facebook, and this is how they actually got out. Gamal Girgis, who actually put a 3-paragraph article on the movie, it got out, it got onto Facebook, and imams and others actually urged people to go out through Facebook and social media to go out and protest. So there's this Middle Age aspect of it, and then you have the 21st century aspect of social media getting people incited and out in the streets.
So how does free speech, the right to free speech, the protection of free speech in this country and in much of the West interface with people who say, you can't say certain things, and we have a right not to be offended by your blasphemy? How do we bridge that gap?
That is the clash of cultures.
Yeah. I think it's important to underline it's not just a matter of taste. Well, we have a right not to be offended. Why, how can you offend us? There's a real threat because of the power of our culture. We're basically a solvent, which is destroying, is liable to destroy, and these people have watched for a century, the kind of unity of these cultures being destroyed by the powerful paradigm of Western material culture, but also our spiritual culture, our rock and roll, the whole set of things. The young people are doing that. So it's a sort of a life choice. In fact, one of the major intellectual who formed the Jamiati Islam, the Brotherhood in Egypt, had a traveling fellowship, probably supported by the State Department, to of all places, Greeley, Colorado, where he spent a year as a graduate student, was horrified by what he saw going on. He got invited to one of the mixers early on, a couple weeks out of being in Egypt, and there were actually men and women mixing, and it was just totally immodest in Greeley, University in Northern Colorado. So it's this thing that's a threat as well as just a matter
and
of
do
taste.
They, and do they have a right and a reason to feel threatened? All they have to do is look at the immolation, I think that's the word, of the American native culture by these same forces.
Well said.
Okay. Mohammed in Charlotte emails, it is clear the Middle East has a cancer of extremism, most certainly a result of 60 years of dictatorial rule installed and supported by Western governments. Walking away or over-insulating ourselves now will only allow the extremism to flourish. More effective diplomacy and engaging dialogue coupled with democracy will empower the moderates to silence the small extremist elements over time. Comment.
I would like to take that.
Sure.
When I was in Afghanistan, I was actually so impressed with our diplomatic corps. We are not in this fortress. They are out there talking to people, being active. We have about 1,200 people with USAID and other organizations who are out there in Afghanistan, in the mountains, in the villages, at personal risk, and they're doing their job. There's a whole a new set of diplomacy that's going on since President Bush started it and President Obama is continuing, called transformational diplomacy, which is exactly what Mohammed is talking about. Our diplomats going out, talking to people, trying to understand, being involved, providing aid where it's necessary, and trying to protect our view of the world and explain it as best possible. Now, that's exactly what Ambassador Stevens was doing in Benghazi.
Mm-hmm.
He did get a little bit overconfident, in my opinion, because he was there for 6 years. He knew everyone there, and he felt that he's protected there. They say, the locals say, that it was outsiders who came, were armed, and took him out. So it is also very, very untrue to say that he was fully unprotected, as Ambassador Arvin just said. He had protection for a consulate, but it was an unexpected situation that happened.
I want to come back to this concept of transformational diplomacy in a second. But one of the things that came out of this Benghazi situation, I think, for the first time that I recognize, were there were people interviewed by Western media in that country who said, "We're so sorry for what happened. This does not represent our views." They were shot by photographers with signs saying that this, we apologize. This is not our view. This is, how do you explain the moderate point of view being able to accept this kind of blasphemy in their eyes and yet get over it and move on versus the extremist point of view that can't?
I'm not sure that even the moderates are asking people to accept the blasphemy. I think that there's a sense that it's okay to be offended by it, and it's okay, but that the resort to violence is not the way to go. And I do think that the majority are moderates who say that. And you're right that there were signs, there were people expressing, saying we're sorry for this having happened.
I mean, after 9/11, there were cries on the part of many people in this country for where are the moderates? Where why are you not standing up and saying what in your culture, in your religion, that this is wrong? Well, here's an example of them standing up and saying, this is wrong, we don't agree with this, this is the wrong way to do things. Is this a new trend, or has it been happening all along, it's just not being reported on?
Well, if you look at if you look at Islam, more than a billion people, there's a very, very minute percentage of those people who are the radicals who are causing the trouble. The great, great majority of Muslims in the world are peace-loving, family-loving, good people.
A point that these people were trying to make.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the radicals, the people on the fringes have taken over the whole dialogue. And when you do something like happened in Benghazi, where essentially, in my opinion, what happened was there was a group of terrorists who used the demonstrations as their method of getting in. I mean, they brought heavy mortars and RPGs to the fight, and that's not a group of just active demonstrators who get out of control. This was a group of terrorists that came in my view,
mm-hmm.
and with the intention of catching the ambassador away from the embassy and killing him to make a point. And the investigations that are being conducted now will probably prove that out.
And what was the point? That we can do it?
Well, the point was to foment dissension and continue to have the debate go on between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world.
It seems to me there's you've got to think about the politics in those particular countries. The inheritors of power in both Tunisia and in Egypt are the moderate Muslims, the moderate branch. And we have to be very careful in America not to say anything which has Islam in its name is a threat. But they're in a very difficult political situation. So it's quite possible that part of the dynamic going on here is for the extreme right wing to try to mobilize people to push the center and build a wedge between us. And look at Turkey if you're looking at a place where an Islamic regime can succeed.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at British American School of Charlotte with an international personalized curriculum for children starting at age 2, hosting an open house Wednesday, October 3rd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Details at britishschoolofcharlotte.org. And Premier Home Healthcare Service is a home care agency providing medical and non-medical services, consultations about transitional or long-term healthcare needs for families at 704-521-4900. Presidential politics and foreign policy, what Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are saying and not saying about American involvement in the Middle East, the topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Here at WFAE, our job is to listen. And one of the things we've heard is that you understand why we have pledge drives, but wish they didn't last so long. Well, by listening to you, we've come up with a plan. Our goal is to raise $550,000 over 10 days. But for every $55,000 raised before the drive begins, we'll drop one day of fundraising. So please, help shorten WFAE's fall pledge drive by making your pledge now at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're joining our conversation in progress here. We have with us in the studio Ambassador Mark Irwin, L.J. Stambuk, President of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte, Dr. Bill Brandon, a Metrolina Medical Foundation Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Beth Whitaker, with the Associate Professor and Associate Chair of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. We were just talking about, off the air, how we have the fringes, the squeaky wheels, getting all the attention here in that part of the world. But the same is true of our country, and it seems that the world is balkanizing, that we're going left and right, or whatever your version of opposites are in your culture. That seems to be where we're going. Can two cultures, East and West, both moving to the extremes, be productive in any way?
It makes you think of Kipling, right? East is East and West is West.
But we have East and West here. We have East and West there. There's nobody in the middle talking. I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah. I think it's important, you know, if you think about here, we were just talking off air how now politicians are punished if they compromise. Compromise is seen as a bad word. And and this is what's happening in many of these countries that we're talking about. It's the same thing that you know, they lose their support base if they reach out to the other side, or if they are moderates. I mean, this whole situation has put the new president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, in a very tough situation. Because he, you know, clearly was slow to come out against the protesters, in part because he understood and supported their right to protest against their feelings against this film. But at the same time, you know, Egypt is not wanting to break ties with the U.S. and not wanting to lose $2 billion a year that it gets. And so now he's come, you know, out with statements against the violence, but not again. And it's a very fine line to walk. And I think, especially when you talk about countries that are becoming more democratic, like Egypt, politicians are playing a game where they're trying to get as much support, just as the politicians are doing that here.
Prior to the break, one of you used the word debate between East and West, the clash of cultures debate. Would there be a debate without these eruptions of violence on occasion? Or would our power, our sheer size, our sheer girth simply squash it all, our way or the highway?
Well, after World War II, we did for quite some time. But all things run in cycles, and the world runs in cycles. And this is a time where balkanization is sort of the up part of the cycle. But over the long run, it'll move back to the center. It's just a question of how you get things back there and how long it's going to take, both in our culture and in the Middle Eastern cultures. Right now, the fringes are in charge. And part of that's brought on by, in my opinion, the world media, because if you look at this pastor down in Florida, who little teeny church in Florida had no standing at all in the overall Christian community. I don't know. I think he had less than 100 parishioners, and he caused all kinds of trouble. Well, that would never have happened without world media picking up his statements and throwing them out there for the whole world to see. It wasn't like Billy Graham said all this stuff. It was some little, I mean, and there are probably thousands of other little pastors in little communities saying just the same thing, and probably saying on the other extreme something similar. They didn't get any publicity, but this little guy caused world chaos for a few days. And that media temptation to sensationalize, and you look at the demonstrations, if you could see the wide camera shot of demonstrations, you'd see that there are 40 people there.
Hmm.
But the close camera shot, it looks like the whole world is there.
Right.
And that's the problem that we're facing, exacerbated by the news media needing to sell more commercials for all the airtime that they all have now. We have a proliferation of media, all of whom are trying to survive. And the only way they can do that is
by being irresponsible?
Out-publicize. Your word,
the
not mine.
The only voice of reason, Mike.
and, you know, look at Kate Middleton over in
Well, that does
on
put
vacation.
Us in a sticky wicket. What, I mean, it is news that some two-bit pastor in Florida wants to burn Korans. That is news in some way. Is it our fault that some local station in Florida reports that as news and it gets picked up either on Facebook or Twitter or by the national media and broadcast to a part of the world that will become inflamed by that? Whose fault is that? It is news.
It is news. There's no question it's news. And when you have a huge amount of capacity, airtime, by all of these stations, television, radio, et cetera, and a little bit of news, that little bit of news goes a long way. And so we because of our system, and I'm not saying our system's wrong, it's just what it is, but because of our system of free enterprise and capitalism, it exacerbates the extremes.
And the other problem is that we live in a world where the media is free to say or do pretty much anything that it wants to. And these people that are being impacted by this and who are protesting against it live in countries with no tradition of that, where the media has been highly controlled. And so if it comes from the media, it must be government sanctioned in their minds. Is there ever a way to make them understand that in this culture – that is not the case.
Clearly, some of the protesters have been saying they're going to protest until the U.S. government does something about this video. And I think there's a lack of understanding of the fact that there's really nothing that can be done about this this video. So, but I also think, you know, going back to the question of diplomatic security, this gets back to when people sign into the Foreign Service and they join the Foreign Service, they expect to be defending U.S. policy, U.S. government policy, and that's what they sign on for. And I have friends who have served under different administrations. Sometimes they don't always agree with U.S. government policy, but that's what they've signed on to talk about and defend and to promote. However, in this case, you have U.S. Foreign Service officers being targeted for something that a private U.S. citizen has done that is deplored by the U.S. government, this video. And so, again, with technology and with media and whatever, it blows it up. And you have Ambassador Stevens having lost his life for a video that some fringe person made. And I've only seen a little bit of it, but it's not a very good one.
I don't think that's why he lost his life. I think he was targeted by terror.
Yes, they were using it as a pretext.
Let me jump in, if I may. All politics are local. There is a huge revolution going on in the Middle East, the Arab Spring. All of these new countries that have new governments are not stable. They're all politicking and fighting for power. Libya has no central government. The radicals are trying to get the upper hand. By doing what they did, they got visibility with the radical elements. They also show they exist. They're trying to take over the agenda there. The same thing is happening in Egypt, the same thing in Tunisia. These are new governments. It's a revolution. It's a new world. It's about politics. There's a debate, actually, about how this movie is being used by the radicals versus the moderates for infighting within the Islamic world and the Middle East to gain the upper hand. So it all kind of comes together, and it's about power, it's about politics. It's much deeper than just a bad movie and people reacting to it.
And unfortunately, it's about trophies.
Dr. Brandon.
Yeah. I'd like to jump in, since one of the themes of this program is cultural competency, the two cultures. Say a good word about the American media or Western media in general. And one of the things about having it out there is things are subject to criticism. Now, sometimes we're upset how long it takes or whatever, but it's widely available, and one thing every media wants to do is try to undermine their competition. So they'll try to find the holes in it. However, in the Middle East, where there isn't a free flow of information, one of the things we need to understand about that is this is a world where conspiracy rules. And intelligent academics, people, the equivalent sitting around a table like this, at least in Tehran, I know, and I bet you in Cairo as well, they would have these really incredibly wild-blown theories. The one when I was last in Iran that I heard by university-educated international relations people was that the United States was responsible for al-Qaeda so that we could have a reason to attack Afghanistan.
And the same thing came
I've
out
heard
of Libya.
That in this country. Yeah. I've heard that in this country.
Yeah, well, it also came out in Benghazi that we actually killed ambassadors so we can send in the warships and take over Libya and put in our people in charge there. So
nobody's going to say it's nonsense.
But that's what they're reporting. There are people there who are saying this, and they're telling it to their people, and they're believing it because they believe everything they get from the media.
Ambassador Irwin.
I was recently in Cuba, 90 miles off our shore. Extremely tightly controlled media, extremely tightly controlled computer access, internet access, almost non-existent, 90 miles off our shore. Radio Martin, our propaganda channel, projecting into Cuba. There were 29 U.S. ambassadors, including me, that went down to try to continue to pave the way toward bringing Cuba closer to us. And if you speak to the common man on the street, they're worried about feeding their family. The per capita income there is about $25 a month. It's a desperate place. But in order to control the changes taking place in Cuba, they control the media, period. End of story. We have an American citizen sitting in a jail down there with a 15-year sentence because he tried to bring into the country satellite uplink equipment, which is completely illegal. So if you control the media, you control the culture. And Cuba still is doing that. Well, multiply that times 10 when you go over to these other countries. It's a difficult challenge that's going to take many years to resolve.
I want to come back to a topic that L.J. Stambaugh brought up two segments ago, and that is the concept of transformational diplomacy. This was started during the Bush administration. It sent diplomats into war zones and other trouble spots to promote democracy and U.S. interests. The policy was expanded under President Obama. Was Ambassador Stevens in Libya or at this consulate in Benghazi in part because of this policy? Do we know?
Well, don't forget, he was the envoy that we sent in 2011 to help the rebels against Gaddafi. And before that, he was deputy chief of mission. So he was very cognizant and knowledgeable about Libya. Why was he in Benghazi?
There was some formal opening, like ribbon cutting. And so he went there to celebrate the beginning of, I don't know, a cultural program or something.
I think the answer is yes.
Okay. Well, it's one thing to put diplomats in countries where we want to spread understanding in the American way of life and help people build hospitals and infrastructure and schools. It's another, I think, to put them into war zones. We are doing that under this program. And Assistant Secretary of State Eric Boswell told a Senate committee this summer that the department now operates diplomatic missions in places where, in the past, we likely would have closed the post and evacuated all personnel. Why is that? Why do we do this?
Transformational diplomacy.
But does it work? Is it fair? Well, are we sending these people in with the proper training, with the proper security? Obviously not.
We used to call this nation building before it was called transformational diplomacy. It's the same policy, really.
It's a belief that one way that we inform our foreign policy is through knowledge from people getting out there, right, and from the foreign service officers getting out there and talking to average people in that country. But clearly there are security issues that can come with that.
And yet at the same time, we're operating in places that we would have closed in years gone by and actively sending people in.
The Observer reported on Saturday that despite an increased budget to do this and to provide diplomatic security, there are manpower shortages, and that has forced the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security to rely on private security contractors. These are not Marines that are protecting these people. They now comprise 90% of the workforce, of the security workforce. Is that a good thing? Well, is it a safe thing? I mean, are they as good as the Marines?
I think it depends what the threat is, obviously. And I mean, as Bill was talking about, the embassies, U.S. embassies in many countries now have those outbuildings where you do go through security, and all of that is private, you know, contractors that are local hires. And you really only encounter the Marines once you get into the embassy building. And on an average day at the U.S. embassy in Nairobi, that's fine.
Well, keep in mind that it's the host country's responsibility to protect the diplomats from foreign nations. That is their primary job. And the security that an ambassador has or an embassy has of their own is extremely limited.
But in a situation where in Afghanistan, for instance, where we can't even protect our soldiers from the soldiers they are training, does this make sense? Is this lunacy on our part? Who are we kidding here?
Well, you have to put in perspective. We had 51 casualties, which is tragic, but there's 350,000 of Afghan soldiers. There's 100,000 of our soldiers, 51 in that perspective, in a huge, huge country, 28 million people. You have to put it in perspective. As I said, there's 1,100 people out there from the USAID and others who are not protected. Diplomats don't work weapons,
yeah.
And they're doing their job in Afghanistan and not attack.
And in Egypt, where they protested a lot over the last several days against the United States, although I don't think anybody has died over there because of it, that's a country that we send $2 billion a year to. $2 billion that we don't have, by the way, in foreign aid to these people. It's second only in foreign aid to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might look at that and look at us just throwing money down a rat hole. Explain to me why we're not. Why that's not the case. If they feel that way about us, they're raging in the streets about us, and we're giving them $2 billion
a year. Well, first of all, we should clarify that it's not just foreign, it's foreign and military aid, so a large percentage of that is military aid. But this goes back to what I was saying about the president of Egypt before, that he's in a difficult spot, and now the Egyptian security forces are protecting the embassy, and clearly a message has been sent on that. But that whole deal with Egypt and Israel goes back to the late 70s and a peace dividend and a whole other program for you.
To be explicit, this was part of the deal that led Egypt to sign a peace treaty with Israel. So it's part of our policy supporting Israel, and
we want Egypt to continue to support Israel.
We must stop.
That's another show. Dr. Beth Whitaker and Dr. Bill Brandon from UNC Charlotte, L.J. Stambuck from the World Affairs Council of Charlotte, and Ambassador Mark Irwin. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.